We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff, we have liftoff.
Hello and welcome to 10 Questions. Today I'm interviewing Australian actor Damon Herriman. Damon started off as a child actor on The Sullivans. We're going to talk about that and The Big Steal. He's gone on to appear in Love My Way, Laid and Secret City. He was In Excess manager Chris Murphy in the miniseries In Excess Never Tear Us Apart. And more recently, he starred in the Cronulla Riots film Down Under. His US credits are pretty spectacular. He's appeared in Breaking Bad, Wilfred, I had to mention that one, the Clint Eastwood film J. Edgar, 5 seasons of the FX series Justified, and more recently the HBO Cinemax series Quarry. In this interview, he talks about his relationship with his dad, who brought him up, he was a single dad, his path to Hollywood, and working with such greats as Pacino, DiCaprio, Eastwood, and the writer and director David Mamet. I really enjoyed doing this interview, particularly because he interrogates the questions I ask. And as usual, I start by asking Damon when he was most happy.
Interesting thinking about that question. When was I most happy? It's hard to really answer that question completely honestly, because I think nostalgia colours that so much.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, there were certainly times as a child that in my memory, I feel like they were some of the happiest times of my life. But when I think back, I go, no, but you were hating going to school and, you know, all those things that worry you or whatever when you're a kid. But kind of in the rose-coloured glasses version of it, you kind of remember that time as being a very happy time. So I certainly have happy memories from childhood, but I particularly have a very happy memory of the year of being 29, which was 1999. I feel like, again, it might be coloured by nostalgia, but I feel like that was the happiest year.
Your sudden returns.
Of my life. Yeah, I guess it was that thing of, I felt... I just moved out of, I was living in Wollstonecraft up until then in Sydney. I'd grown up in Adelaide.
Oh, yeah.
Lived in Alice Springs for part of my childhood and then moved to Sydney, lived in Wollstonecraft. And in 99, I moved to Camperdown, which is, you know, for people in Sydney would know Camperdown, but people out of Sydney, it's a kind of a cool, fun inner city.
Yeah, right.
Whereas Wollstonecraft was more of a leafy, suburban vibe. And I moved in with a girl who was one of my best friends, and it was just a great year. It wasn't even a particularly good career year. It was sort of in a patch where I wasn't working that much. I was sort of mainly earning money doing voiceovers at the time, but I just had a great time in that year. I just remember it being fun.
And
you know, I'm sure there were other years that were fun, but that one sticks out to me where I just was really enjoying being alive at that time, at that age.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, well, 29 is an interesting time for people because it's either the year where it's a year of change. Often it's quite tumultuous.
Mm.
You know, often it's like a career change or a relationship breakup or a death. But you had beer and Skittles for you, so
yeah, it was, and it was also, you know, I was still. You know, you're in your 20s, you still have that kind of youthful exuberance of being in your 20s, but you've kind of learnt a lot more about life by then too.
Yeah.
So you're kind of in this nice patch where you still love going to parties all night, but you can also have interesting dinner party conversations.
You're making transit. You can have both.
Yeah.
You still got the youthful exuberance, man.
Right.
It has not left you. Question two, who would you like to apologise to and why?
I don't feel like I have anyone specific that I would want to apologise to, but I would want to apologise to anyone I've hurt, I would think. I really try to live a life where I am very conscious of not hurting people.
Yeah.
So I if I'm going to say or do something, I tend to think about how I would react if someone else said or did that to me, and try to work out a way to not do it or to lessen the impact.
Yeah, yeah. Was that always part of your the way you operated, or did you learn empathy like that later on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I feel like my mum probably instilled that in me to some degree about, you know, being nice to people and not hurting people, and that's not a nice thing to say, or you shouldn't, you know, shouldn't make someone feel bad. But I think I also have just been always very aware of, I wouldn't like I've never, for example, never cheated on a girlfriend, and a part of that is, I guess, just you shouldn't do that, it's a moral thing, but it's part of it is also just because I've been cheated on and it's horrible. It's like, well, I don't quite know if you've been through how horrible that is, how you could then just go and do it because you felt how horrible it was to have it done to you. So, I don't know. I guess that's just
it's great.
It's just something that I've always had in my way of thinking. So I would just apologize to anybody I had hurt and say that my intention was probably not to do that, or at least, you know, if it was, then I was probably misguided. I'm sorry.
That's nice, man. It's very good. Question 3, buddy. What's your greatest regret?
Well, anyone who knows me well, Adam, knows that I'm constantly filled with regret. There's no one great regret. It's a kind of a daily kind of torment of regret. Or I'll almost certainly be regretting a question or two from this interview when you leave. I'm quite a regretful person. Someone who, it's a horrible thing, attribute to have, to be constantly regretting things, because it's, you just find, you know, that you any email you've sent or any conversation you've had or any decision you've made, you're weighing up whether that's going to fall into the regret category, and I tell you what, more often than not, there's something to regret.
100%, mate. You know, Amanda always asks me why I don't want to go out. It's because I'll probably go out, socialise, and say something I'll regret, and then hate myself for 24 hours afterwards.
Okay, so you understand.
Oh, totally, mate, totally.
You get it.
So, you know, I will literally just be beating myself up after a great night.
Right.
For about 2 days.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes I'm regretting things that I've created, a story in my head that is worthy of regret. And I discover that the person who I thought might have been offended by something that I'm now regretting saying hadn't even heard it, or thought it was hilarious and didn't care. Like, I create it's like I will go out of my way to create the most regrettable version of something.
Yeah.
So I can regret it the most and just be, you know, in a kind of a niggled kind of state for the next sort of 48 hours.
We should be kind to ourselves. I think that's the thing.
I know. Like, why can't? Wouldn't it be great ourselves to be one of those people who has the people have a phrase, no regrets. That's a saying.
Yeah.
No regrets. Whatever. Just live your life. No regrets. No regrets.
10 billion regrets. I'll see your no regrets.
I'll raise you.
That's awesome, mate. What, question 4, what will you still need to do to feel you've lived a satisfactory life?
Well, I suppose, I don't have kids, and I always thought I would have kids. I had no doubt I would have kids. And, you know, I'm 46 now, and I don't have kids. So I don't know if I will or not. I guess it's possible, but it's also not necessarily likely. I guess it's... So, look, you know, I feel like the people I know that do have kids, talk about it in such a way that makes me feel like it's something I require to have a satisfactory life. Yeah. But I don't necessarily feel it myself. It's almost like I feel like it must be the case because people say that it is, rather than me actually feeling a void of any kind.
Yeah, I mean, do you sit here by yourself at night and go, I wish I had kids? Or
No, I don't, no. But I also see friends with their kids and hear them talking about, you know, amongst the lack of sleep and inability to do anything ever again that they feel like doing when they want to do it. They say that despite that, it's the best thing they ever did and they wouldn't have it any other way. So I can only assume that's true because most of them say it. Yeah. But I also, I guess, you know, you don't miss what you don't, you've never had or what you don't know. No. So I don't miss it. But I guess, yeah, there's still a part of me that thinks, well, I guess that's the next thing to do. And that would be for me who is in a sense still living in a way like I was when I was 29, you know, nothing much has changed.
Well, yeah, that was your big year where you said, this is how I'm going to live the rest of my life.
This is the best year of my life. I just try and keep it like this from now on. So I guess, you know, that would be very much a new phase. But if that didn't happen, I feel pretty satisfied anyway. You know, I feel like if this is what it is, I have great friends, family I love, and a work that I've been really fortunate to be getting to do. So I feel like I'd be pretty satisfied anyway.
Yeah, mate, from an outsider's perspective, you're living a great life. Question five. Who is the person who most influenced you and how?
Probably my dad. My dad brought my brother and I up as a single father from when I was five. And so I would have to say it would be him because I spent my formative years with him.
Yeah.
And my dad's a really funny guy. I think I probably got my sense of humour to a large degree from my dad. Certainly instilled that idea of, you know, of manner. I think, you know, manners was a big deal with him. And very much so because I was acting as a kid. I did a lot of acting when I was around 10, 11, 12.
Sullivans? What?
The Sullivans was the first.
Yeah, right. Who were you in the Sullivans?
I played a character called Frank Errol, who was a little boy whose father was at war and he went to live with Terry Sullivan for a while and then with Mrs. Jessup next door.
Wow.
Great memories. My dad also very much instilled in me, which is something I still kind of probably am very much, you know, have in the back of my head, not to be full of yourself or to brag or to be boastful about the fact that you were an actor, you know, and I guess, you know, being a kid, a fear for many parents if they have a child actor in the family is that they're going to become this little precocious kind of brat who thinks they're something special. My dad definitely would always push and instill in me that, you know, there was nothing special about that and you were no different. And that's certainly something that's stayed with me. Ironically, my dad is quite boastful and brags a lot about me now, which is quite interesting. Given that he was so, I often say to him, Dad, you spent my entire life telling me not to brag, and now all you want to do is post stuff about me on social media.
He's great, your dad. We all know him because we've met him at all the award shows. He's your plus one in many times. How did why it was unusual in those days for it to be brought up by a single dad?
Mm.
So what happened there? If you
look, I. It was very unusual. I mean, he got custody. I don't really. It's been a while since I've even asked about it. I think it was a situation that he really wanted to have custody, and my mum had a new relationship. And,
yeah, right.
And she was, I guess, didn't want to take away his kids from him, as well as have him lose his partner, you know.
Makes sense.
But we kept seeing my mum as well.
And is your brother an older brother or younger?
He's 2 years older.
Okay, right, okay. And when did, just to touch on the acting side of things, when did your dad decide it might be a good idea to get young Damon an agent.
Well, we were living in Alice Springs at the time, and my dad had started doing radio commercials in Alice Springs.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, like, and they were unpaid.
What, as a voiceover?
As a voiceover artist.
Yeah. Really?
I've got some cassette tapes of his voiceover from the time. And it was a thing, it was weird. You didn't get paid to do them. You did them as like a privilege.
Like amateur theatre or something?
It was like amateur theatre, and he was doing amateur theatre, and they would get people from the amateur theatre company to come in and do radio commercials, but for brands. I mean, they were brand name companies that got free voiceover talent. I don't know how that's
great.
How that worked. But anyway, there were a series of father-son commercials for, as they were called then, Nestle's Chocolates. Of course, it's Nestle now, but they were called Nestle's back in the 70s. And my dad said, oh, well, my son sort of does little kind of acting things for the family and stuff. Maybe I could do it with him, seeing as a father and son. So we did these ads together. And then my dad kind of got excited about these commercials, these radio commercials that we'd done. And decided that perhaps I could be an actor. And we were going to be moving back to Adelaide, where I was born. And my dad wrote a letter to Peter Weir, who, you know, a legendary film director, who at the time, I guess, had done Picnic at Hanging Rock, and maybe he'd done The Last Wave at that point as well. Peter Weir wrote back, I still have the letter, saying, what's your advice? I think my son could be an actor. And Peter Weir said, oh, well, if you're going to be going to Adelaide, look up this agent, Ann Peters, who was the only agent in Adelaide. We did that, went to Adelaide, I think, sent her the tapes of the Nestle's commercials. And went and did an interview with her, and she took me on. So I then kind of started doing TV commercials as a kid in Adelaide, and about, I don't know, 18 months after that, the role in The Sullivans came up.
That's brilliant. And what did your dad actually do? What was his
real job? He worked for an insurance company.
Okay, and so keen amateur theatre person.
Yeah, he was sort of doing amateur theatre as a hobby, really. Yeah.
And he
then got into doing a bit of screen work after that, mainly. Bit of extra work. He's also, for those with a keen eye who have seen the film Candy, he's the celebrant who marries Heath Ledger and Abby Cornish. Very small role. You're looking like,
yeah.
You know, remind me of the celebrant. Yeah,
I've seen the film twice. I think it's a remarkable film.
I mean,
film.
It's just a guy. He's just standing saying, do you take,
Unfortunately, for copyright reasons, I can't play the scene, but in it, Damon's dad, Noel, is acting in front of Heath Ledger, Abby Cornish, Jeffrey Rush, Tom Budge, Noni Hazelhurst, Tony Martin. It's a crowd of very heavy hitters that would make a lesser man nervous. But Noel's great.
It's great talking about your dad, because I've met him a few times now.
He loves you, mate.
Oh, thank you, mate. I think question six we're up to, and that is, when was the last time you cried and why?
Look, I don't cry a lot in life. I tend to get a bit teary if I watch a sad movie or a sad news story. I think the last time I cried was probably watching Lion. So I think that was the last time. But there are probably other times I've forgotten. You know, if I'm watching a good documentary or something where there's something particularly moving, I'll tear up, but it tends to happen more in having an actual life cry. I don't do that often. That probably only, I reckon I only would have that happen maybe once every 18 months, 2 years.
And can you cry when needed to on screen?
I can, not always. I wish I found it easier. I love it. It's a great feeling when it happens. When you have a scene where it either requires you to cry or you feel like the scene would be enhanced by that, it's a great feeling when you get there, and it's an incredibly frustrating one when you don't, because it's kind of, for me, out of my control. It's like you know, it's a bit like sneezing. I mean, you can fake a sneeze, but that's not a sneeze. That's just you making a noise like a sneeze. And I feel like crying is a bit the same. It's like you can fake that you're crying, but that's not actually crying. You know, you, and you genuinely need to be moved to tears to cry. And I've certainly had acting scenes where I have been able to, and then other ones where I haven't. I wish, you know, I envy those actors who can turn it on like a tap.
Question 7. What is your current state of mind, Damon?
Regret, obviously.
Which question did you start feeling the regret?
All of them, to some degree. I'm pretty content, I would say. I feel happy. I feel lucky. I definitely feel lucky. I'm very aware, certainly in terms of, you know, career stuff, how much luck comes into it. And, you know, I have so many friends who are incredibly talented actors who are either not working or are not working as much as they should, or are working but aren't working at a level that they want to be working. And the only thing that separates them and me, I feel, to a large degree, is just the timing and right place, right time, and, you know.
Well, you got there's that. I mean, that's really, you're being modest there. But not only is the talent thing a factor, but also you took a risk by coming here in 2005. You're pretty much an early adopter of Australians coming to LA. I mean, it probably weren't. Is it 2005 you came here, or earlier? But I mean, you know, there weren't many. I mean, now there's 40,000 Australians in LA.
Right.
There weren't that many when you came over, and it would have been a challenge. It would have been a risk, and you took that risk.
Yeah, what was I guess it didn't feel like a huge risk so much as. I mean, it's funny. I don't want people to think I'm obsessed with regret. It really sounds pathetic. But my whole coming here in the first place, I called it regret insurance. That was my kind of thing. As opposed to, it was never a, as it is for a lot of people, and I kind of envy them in a way, who have that drive and that I'm going to show them, I'm going to go get them, and Hollywood, here I come. I'm, you know, that feeling of, yes, this is my destiny to go and work in America, and I'm going to make it happen. I never had that.
So regret insurance. Regret insurance means so you don't regret it later in life.
I didn't want to be. I didn't want to be 80, going, you know, when I did that film House of Wax that was American that we shot in Queensland, I probably could have gone to America and tried to get an agent out of that, and I didn't. And I, God, now. I'm never going to know what would have happened. And so for me, that's why I did come over after I did House of Wax. It was because I didn't want to regret not doing it. It was so that I could put to bed that regret.
That's
great. I could put to bed so that I could say, yeah, no, I tried that. In fact, I tried it under the best circumstances I could. I had an American credit, and I went over there on the back of an American film at the time the film was coming out, and it didn't work out. So at least I know, no worries. You know, whereas had I not done it, I always would have been wondering. So that was, you know, but it didn't ever feel like a risk in a way, because I wasn't really giving anything up to do it, and I only was coming for 3 months, and that's what I used to do, is I would just come over here for 3 months and then go home for 3 or 4 months and then come back here for 3 months. So it was just kind of a very slow and steady thing. Again, just, and, you know, because I'm very much, you know, I think a realist about these things. I was like, you know, I'm a 35-year-old actor who plays kind of character-y roles. I don't really have any big credits that they know apart from this little role in House of Wax. Why am I going to have a career here over anyone else? There's no exciting kind of angle to me. You know, I'm not that guy that was in that movie at Sundance. I'm just some guy. So I was always thinking, well, this is probably not going to happen. But but then I would, after a couple of trips, I hadn't got any work, and then the third trip was going to be my last.
Really?
Well, I just figured if I'd done three trips of 3 months each over 2 years, and nothing had happened at all, like hadn't even got a call back or something, then I would be thinking, well, then I'm deluded if I keep coming back, because it's been proven that I'm not going to get work here. That's how I was thinking. And then I got on that third trip, I got one guest role on one show, and that kind of changed everything, because that made me then go, oh, it's possible.
It's real.
It's gone from impossible to possible just from that one little job.
And what was the job?
It was an episode of a show called The Unit, which was a CBS show created by David Mamet, the filmmaker. And by just pure luck, he happened to be the writer-director of that episode. So my very first film was with
David Mamet. That would have been interesting working with him, because he's written so many books on acting and things like that.
Well, and I hadn't read any of them, but I immediately went and bought True and False, I think
it's called. Yeah.
True or False.
Yeah. Damon was right. It's called True and False, and it's Mamet's instructional guide to acting, a formula based on common sense and being loyal to the script.
Because I was about to shoot this thing with him, and I thought, well, he's gonna be asking me things or using his techniques in his direction.
Yeah.
I'm not going to know what he's talking about. So I don't want to look like an idiot. So I read his book, and I'm all there ready to kind of talk about actions and objectives and things. Didn't do any of it. None of it. I mean, in fact, his only direction was faster. David, just sing it faster.
No worries.
Which I thought was funny, because he's kind of known for rapid fire dialogue. I guess faster then.
I can do that. I can do faster.
But he was lovely. I actually ended up working two other times with him after that.
Really? What on?
I did. 6 months later, I did a small role in a film called Red Belt that he
yeah.
And then about, he obviously lost interest after that, about 8 years passed, and I got this call one day from his assistant asking whether I was in Los Angeles on a particular date, and I was in New York at the time, and I said, well, I'm in New York doing this show, and I don't know if I'm going to be in Los Angeles then. I'm thinking, well, I want to hear what this is about, because maybe I can be. And she said, well, okay, well, I'll tell you what it is. Basically, Dave's got a new play. It's a two-hander, and he hasn't heard it out loud, so he just wants to hear it read, really. And so it would just be a reading with you and Dave and Al Pacino. And I picked my jaw up off the floor, said, hold on, sorry, you're saying that I would be reading a new play of Dave's with Al Pacino? Yeah. I mean, it's mainly Al. He's the lead, but you know, it's a two-hander. And I said, I'm positive I can be in LA on that day. Just let me get back to you.
Wow. And so you did that?
Yeah, I did that.
And I mean, was it?
It was just like
you and Al and
Dave. Pinch yourself. You know, the most sort of pinch yourself. It was four people in a boardroom at a hotel. David Mamet, Al Pacino, the director who had just won the Tony Award for Best Director, and me. It was ridiculous. And of course, the whole time you're just sitting there thinking, how would people behave in this situation if they genuinely felt like they should be here? And I should try and act like that, whatever that is. Like, you know, you're trying to sit in a relaxed fashion. Do relaxed people cross their legs? I think relaxed people cross their legs. I'll cross my legs. This feels contrived. I won't cross my legs. Yeah, it was pretty, you know, it was pretty, I know people overuse surreal, but it was surreal.
Do you get starstruck at all, or are you contained in that sense?
I mean, inside, I don't go kind of gaga externally, but inside, I was pretty starstruck to be sitting.
That's right, a meter
from Al Pacino, and looking in his eyes and acting with him. That was the thing. I'm looking at, you know, and he was brilliant. Even in that read, it was the most effortless acting I'd ever seen. I was just thinking, how do you make this seem so effortless and so interesting at the same time? I'm probably more likely to get starstruck by a musician, I think. You know, if I met a Beatle or something, I would be.
Yeah. Myself. With me, it's sports people, but sometimes when I'm acting, I haven't acted with the names that you have, but sometimes, like, in the middle of a scene, I'll go, hang on, I'm acting opposite X. It's,
right. Well, that did happen. The other time that happened to that degree was I had a small role in a film called J. Edgar, which was directed by Clint Eastwood and starred Leonardo DiCaprio. So that was, again, a bit like being in that room where I'm trying to act as normally and relaxed as possible. But there were definitely times where there would be a three-way conversation in the middle of the room, and it was me and those two guys, and you're just looking at... It's just, you're standing there, that's Clint Eastwood just there, and that's Leonardo DiCaprio. That, why am I here? This doesn't make any sense. But of course, you know, the other thing you do realise in a lot of these situations is these people are completely normal and lovely. And in fact, yeah. I think to some degree, the more legendary, the more normal and relaxed.
Mm.
You know, it's kind of that mid-level of fame that you often find people misbehave or think they're a bit important. But those two were completely lovely people,
yeah,
and really easygoing and easy to talk to.
In J. Edgar, Damon played Bruno Richard Hauptmann, the German-born carpenter who was convicted of the 1932 abduction and murder of the 20-month-old son of aviator Charles Lindbergh, which caused a massive media sensation and resulted in Hauptmann being executed.
Question eight. What do you consider your greatest achievement?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I feel like, again, going back to kids, I'm sure most people say they're kids if they have kids.
Yeah, and it gets boring, so yeah. I'm glad we don't
have
kids.
What if I say my kids and I don't have kids? That would be less boring because that's a twist on the answer.
We'll do a fact checking.
It's a hard question to answer if you don't have kids or aren't a scientist or something because it's only going to be a selfish one, really. You know, like I haven't, you know, invented something that's going to help the world or created human beings. So I feel like, you know, I guess my greatest achievement personally, I suppose, is a bit pathetic, but it's just getting to work in America, which is something I, as a kid, only ever dreamed of and never would have imagined it actually happening. And so getting to work with people I really respect on jobs that I, you know, 10 years ago would have been... I mean, it's all relative, these things, and you know, the bar keeps changing based on where you're at the particular time.
Yeah,
but, you know, that very first guest role with David Mamet seemed like, you know, for me at the time, would have been like for someone else, like winning an Oscar, because it felt like that big a deal to me.
Yeah.
You know, because I couldn't believe that I was going to be working with David Mamet today. And then, you know, these things keep changing. And what your idea of an achievement is keeps moving.
Mm. But you need to hang on to how you felt, you know, the night before.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And, yeah, look, I feel really, as I said before, I just feel incredibly lucky with the way things have gone and the opportunities I've had here, which have led to opportunities at home, and I'm loved that I'm still working at home as well.
Yeah.
And that's come about to a large degree because of working here. It's one of those things, you know, that happens where you work in America, you're exactly the same actor you were in Australia. Suddenly people, you know, want you to do... bigger and better jobs.
It's amazing how much value Australians put on hopping on a plane.
Yeah.
And travelling 15 hours somewhere.
Yeah.
And being accepted by other people, other countries, people in other countries.
What do other people say to that question that don't have kids?
What do you consider your greatest achievement?
Mm. I mean, does it become a personal one? Because, you know, I mean, unless you also happen to be someone who built an orphanage or something...
No, they generally talk about, mate, I can't remember. So I had to listen back to previous interviews, and people list their greatest achievements as kids, making great television,
kids, surviving, speaking French, kids, spelling the word symmetrical, and appearing in the feature film The Nugget.
If you have kids and don't answer kids to that question, you're going to seem like a really bad person.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, who would you like to apologize to? A lot of people get offended by that question. Well, it's like coming out of rehab. Someone, you know, you got your list of people you need to apologize to, and say, I feel like I need an, say you've been to rehab and I feel like I need an apology from you and I don't get it. And I hear you've apologized to Trent.
Just a warning to future interviewees, this well-meaning podcast has actually caused a lot of pain when people who expect an apology from the interview subject don't get one. So be careful of that. Also be careful of the seemingly innocuous question, when were you most happy?
If you don't say your wedding day or when your first child was born, you're fucked.
Right, it's got to be one of those two, doesn't it?
Yeah. Question 9, mate. Who would you want on your side in a battle and why? And it could be a physical battle or a show business battle.
Well, I was going to ask you that. A physical, because I would just want, obviously if it's physical, I'd want some very large, tough...
Brendan Cowell.
Steve Lamarckland and...
Yeah.
Chris Hemsworth. Handy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, any of the Hemsworths. They can all fight, I'd imagine.
But, yeah, do you mean that more in, like, someone who's got your back?
Or? It's open to interpretation.
Yeah, I think, it would for me, I can't foresee a physical battle taking place of any kind. So I think, but in terms of, someone having your back, I have a really good group of close friends.
Mm.
And I feel like they're very loyal. And my friends and I feel I would, I would happily go into battle with or for any of them, because I do feel a very special bond with my friends, and I have a lot of friends, but I have like most people, a particularly tight group of friends who I feel definitely are very loyal and have certainly been incredible in times of need for me.
That's great. And the final question, mate, what would you like your last words to be?
I think I'd like my last words to be something like, I had no idea death was so painless.
We have ignition sequence start.
Short distance, high impact.
5, 4, 3, 2, all engines running.
10 questions with Adam Zwar. Big names, great minds.
Make yourself a cup of tea.
Liftoff. We have liftoff.